Hello, people. This is John Manimus Medeiros, the part-time revolutionary, speaking to you from Schenectady, New York, on Saturday, October 30th. And this is the third webcast in the mission project that I call Campaign 24. And the topics today are, one, why the two-party system is so deeply entrenched, and two, why the Electoral College is so deeply entrenched and has not been changed, even though some people have wanted to change it. It looks very, very difficult, if not impossible, to change the way that we select the President of the United States. Anyway, first, the two-party system. There's a long and complicated history, but by the early part of this century, there were two parties who could reliably win elections, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And they were very fearful of socialists. Socialists are really just progressive working people who support the power of working people. A socialist is a person who just wants to advance democracy a little further beyond the political realm and into the economic realm. A socialist wants not only a democratic process for conducting elections and making laws, but they want a democratic economy. They want working people to share in the power of government, not just ask for something and then wait for the rich and powerful people, political class, to give what they feel like giving this year or, you know, this decade. And there's a difference between working people expressing their opinion and voting and being, quote, an activist and actually sharing in power. To actually share in power, there has to be parties, political parties representing socialists and working people and progressives, and they have to share in the power after an election. Like if they get, say, 5% of the vote or 10% or 15%, they have to share in the power. They have to get something. They have to get some people into office. They have to get some laws that they want passed. It can't be just this pattern that we have in the U.S. where working people and poor people, march and sing songs and make demands. And if they're not getting their heads cracked open, maybe they get, you know, one-tenth of what they're asking for temporarily just to calm them down. That's the way the system works, the two-party system works in the United States. It's a seesaw. The Republicans represent, as my mother said, the rich, and the Democrats represent working people and the poor. And they have a battle every election is like a football game, and there's one winner and one loser, and the winner exercises the power, and the loser gets what's thrown to them by the winner. Now, the first half of the 20th century, that system didn't work too badly because the nation had to be united to deal with a Great Depression and a war, two wars. Some say that those two wars were really one war that got interrupted by the Depression and some other business. Anyway, the two-party system is a seesaw, and the American people have been trained to ride the seesaw and kind of enjoy the political theater and go along with it and accept that the Republican Party represents the rich and employers, and the Democratic Party represents the employees. And the two-party system is supposed to protect us from extremism. Started in the early part of this century, there really is an unwritten agreement between the Republicans and the Democrats that the mission that they agree upon completely, always, is to prevent socialists from getting any offices, from winning any elections and sharing in the power. They do a very good job. There's very few progressives and socialists who have ever been elected. Bernie Sanders is a socialist, a socialist Democrat, or a democratic socialist. I met him personally in the 1970s. He's a wonderful man and brilliant. He's a miracle. He should have been the Democratic candidate in 2016, but he wasn't because he had socialist in his history and background. And he was elected to offices from the state of Vermont, not because he was a socialist or even because he was a liberal. He was elected because people trusted him. The Vermont voters trusted him. And I'm in a position to know that because I lived in Vermont from 1970 to 2016, 46 years. So there's this unwritten agreement, and there's evidence in history. Right here in the city of Schenectady, there was an alliance between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party to prevent a popular socialist from being elected mayor. Well, he was elected mayor, and in the early part of the 20th century, there were 74 socialist mayors in the United States. One of them was in the city of Bridgeport, where I lived. I lived near Bridgeport. I lived in Fairfield, Connecticut as a child, and I remember seeing Mayor Jasper McLevy walk down the street on Main Street in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So this two-party system is supposed to protect us from extremism, but it certainly doesn't. It didn't. The Klan has infiltrated the Republican Party. White supremacists have infiltrated the Republican Party. They talk and act like fascists. They're against science. The mission of Donald Trump was to wreck the federal government, to just turn it into nothing, not enforce any, important federal laws, to just let the each state do what they wanted. He supported white supremacists, and he came pretty close to wrecking the government, and the Democrats couldn't stop him. So the two-party system has really failed the American people and presents a great danger. And in order to have democracy in the United States of America, we have to break the pattern. We have to do something to disrupt the seesaw of the two-party system. And I have what I think is the best way to do that, and that is to use the Electoral College to compel a party coalition between the Democratic Party and a more progressive or socialist or a more democratic party. That would be, in this case, the party that I now call the Transformation Party, which doesn't exist officially. It's a name, it's an idea, but it could be formed by you if you understand what I am telling you and you accept the challenge of saving the United States of America by breaking the iron grip of the two-party system, which keeps all power in the hands of a very small political class. And when the Republicans are in power, that small political class is dominated by some very blind and selfish people whose only use for government is to write laws that make theft legal and enable them to amass more and more wealth and more power and be in control without sharing any power with the people. So it's the unwritten agreement and the seesaw of American elections which makes the two-party system so deeply entrenched and so difficult to disrupt and change. But it can be done. You can use the Electoral College to take the first step and crack the mold of the two-party system. Now, why is the Electoral College so deeply entrenched? Well, it's really kind of simple, but there are a lot of interesting details. There was a very interesting, messy election in 1876 that played a role in the evolution of the Electoral College as it is today. Now, originally, in the Federalist Papers, Hamilton and Madison described the Electoral College as a committee of learned men, each of which would be nominated by each state according to their congressional representation, which really means according to their population. And these electors would come together and discuss who makes the best president from a selected list, a short list, maybe five candidates, maybe more, maybe six or seven, maybe three. But how these original candidates would come into being, we weren't sure, but there was an assumption political parties would propose candidates for the office of president. The electors would come together, consider the candidates, and choose the one they thought was best. Now, it's interesting, if you read this section of the Federalist Papers, it actually looks like the Electoral College is kind of like a search committee for some kind of office, like a dean of a college or the chief executive officer of a corporation or the head of an organization, chairman of a nonprofit. You know, they have search committees. Churches have search committees. And so they have a method for weeding out all those who simply would not be considered qualified or of interest. And they narrow it down to those who are worthwhile candidates. And it could be a significant number of people. It could be 20 or 30. But the search committee weeds them out further, studies their qualifications, their histories, their resumes, meets with them, and the search committee comes up with a candidate. That wins the game, so to speak. Says, this is the best one. We think you should hire this person. So that's kind of like what it looks like is being described in the Federalist Papers for selection of the president, but it didn't go in that direction at all. I don't have at hand the actual details of time, you know, how this evolved in the 1800s, but I do know that by 1900, the electors were appointed by the political parties. The Democratic Party appoints Democratic electors, the Republican Party appoints Republican electors, and each group of electors has pledged to vote for the candidate of the party that appointed them. Now, this power to appoint the presidential electors is described in an extremely general and vague phrase in the Constitution. The section of the Constitution that discusses the Electoral College and the presidential electors says that the presidential electors of each state shall be appointed by the legislature, by the state legislature, as they may direct. Now, that's a phrase for you, as they may direct. It certainly looks and sounds like they can do anything they want to appoint their presidential electors. They can have a road race. They have five electors in the, you know, the top five who win the race and come in 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 there. They could be the presidential electors. They could have a debate. They can have an oratory competition. They could sell the office of presidential elector. Say whoever offers us the most money will get to be a presidential elector. They could have the people elect them. They could. There's so many different ways. They could have a search committee, and they could select what you might call prominent people. You know, a college professor, a corporate executive who has a reputation for being very smart and wise, and gets along with all parties, you know, somebody who's just got a reputation for being brilliant. So they could use whatever method they choose, and it turns out that the method that was chosen and is in practice by literally every state in the union, all 50 states, is the parties appoint their presidential electors, and their presidential electors are pledged to vote for the party candidate. So how does that happen? Well, some people understand, others don't, but the fact is, if you check with anybody in your state government, especially the Commissioner of Elections or the Department of Elections, they will explain to you that when you vote for a president, you're not really voting for the person who is the candidate for president. You're voting for the electors of that president, who go with that president. So you see, the presidential electors are not people who are going to make a big, deep, important decision. They're messengers. They are messengers. And the states have had this practice in place since the 1900, where you vote for a president, and in 48 of the 50 states, whichever presidential candidate gets the plurality, more votes than any other presidential candidate on the ballot or write-in, they get all the state's presidential electors of that political party. So if you voted for the Democratic candidate for president in New York State, those presidential electors who were pledged to vote for the Democratic candidate go to the state capitol or Washington or whatever it is they need to go, and they cast their ballots for the Democratic candidate. That gets certified and goes to Washington, and it's all described in the law exactly how, you know, the steps that are taken and how it happens. Well, you see, this has been challenged more than once, and it was challenged in 2019, and this became a Supreme Court case called Schiaffalo versus Washington, meaning the state of Washington. And Schiaffalo is spelled capital C-H-I-A-F-A-L-O. Schiaffalo and two or three other presidential electors from the state of Washington wanted to challenge their legal obligation to vote as pledged and to just be messengers. They argued that they are supposed to make a decision. They are electors. They're supposed to discuss the candidates and decide who they think personally is the best candidate. They're not supposed to vote simply as instructed and be just messengers. That was their argument. This argument was not new. It had visited the Supreme Court one or two times before, but conditions change, time changed, and sometimes a challenge that was put down in the past is raised up again. So this was initiated in 2019. There was arguments in May of 2020, and in July, on July 6, 2020, the Supreme Court delivered their decision. You can check this out so easily. It's all online. The decision is Schiaffalo versus Washington. The case number is 19-465. And what the Supreme Court said is so clear, anyone can see and understand what it says. And basically what it says is that the state legislature has absolute control over how the presidential electors are appointed. And that exercise, that control over how they are appointed, also means the state legislature has control over who they vote for. That's right. That's what that decision says, and it says it very clearly and completely. So this system where presidential electors are pledged to vote for a party candidate, Democrat or Republican, is deeply entrenched legally and has been since the beginning of the 20th century. There have been some efforts to change it. There was a proposed amendment that didn't fly, has never been ratified in the time that was allotted, so it's a dead amendment. In any case, this is the way the system works. The Supreme Court made it very clear in this decision in 2020. The legislature can use a different method if they wish, but this method has been the method for 120 years. People are accustomed, the voters of America are accustomed to seeing a ballot that has the names of presidential candidates. And there is talk today, there are Republicans who are saying, well, we control the Republican legislature in our state, we can change the votes. We can change the electors' votes. We can tell them, you know, you can't vote for the Democrat. You got to vote for the Republican. Well, you know what? That is total horseshit. They cannot do that. They would have to change state law before the election, well before the election, and they have to make it very clear to the people of their state, you know, we believe in democracy, and you can vote for a president, but we don't give a shit who you vote for. We're going to decide who gets elected president. We're not going to count your votes. And if they tried to do that, I don't think that would be very popular anywhere, even in the most Republican states, even in the Confederate states. If you want to change the system so that the people are ignored, you got quite a challenge in your hands. Very unlikely you're going to be able to do that. So the election of 2024 is probably going to be very much the same as our past elections according to the rules for elections. There will be presidential candidates on the ballot. You're actually voting for the electors who are matched with that candidate. And if your candidate gets the most popular votes in your state, then that candidate will get all the electoral votes of your state in 48 states, not in Nebraska or Maine. Nebraska and Maine, God bless them, have some kind of a sense of democratic justice, and they award their electoral votes proportionally. It's only, I think one state is 5 and the other is 4. I'm not sure exactly. You can check, but it's only a small number of electoral votes. But in those states, it's possible for 2 or even 3 candidates to get an electoral vote or a couple of electoral votes. So that's very interesting, and it is part of how the Electoral College can be used to disrupt the two-party monopoly, force them into a coalition. And the basis of the coalition would be simple. You just tell the Democratic Party, you have to pass a mandatory voting law, and I'll spell it out later, and you have to pass a law that prohibits party registration when people are registered to vote, because the election authorities in a state have no need of any kind, it's not necessary in any way for them to know how people are going to vote. In fact, when you think about it, it's anti-democratic. Oh yeah, we're going to register you to vote. We want to know how you're going to vote. What the hell's that? No. I'm a voter, and I'm going to register to vote, and I don't want you to know how I'm going to vote. I'm not sure how I'm going to vote. What the hell? Why should you be asking me how I'm going to vote? And that's what party registration is. Party registration is a loose, it's not fixed, but it's a loose commitment, because your ballot is secret. It's a loose commitment to say, hey, I'm a Democrat, or I'm Republican. This is who I like. I like this group. No, that's not democracy. No party registration. So those are the two things that the Transformation Party demands. You have to pass those laws before we donate our electoral votes to you. How are we going to get electoral votes? I'm going to tell you that in future webcasts. Again, I apologize for the length of this webcast. I see it's a little more than 23 minutes. But I just can't make it simple and say it in a few words. I'll keep working at it. But you can check out everything I've said today. And next time, I'm going to talk about why vote donation and party coalition should work. Why it is a reasonable approach and a worthwhile effort to break the mold of the two-party seesaw and save the United States of America from the disaster it is spiraling downward toward. See you next time.